They are moving on Washington, D.C. with the battle cry, Make America Healthy Again. Wow, their battle cry leads us to ask, how can America be made healthy again?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1378th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Ushuaia who are tuned into the Food Chain Podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, America has successfully conducted its regularly scheduled revolution and is now in the process of throwing the old regime out and bringing a new one in. The winners of this revolution campaigned with the battle cry, Make America Great Again. The MAGA folks, as they are called, appeared to be moving with great alacrity and inclusivity in their making. Their list of that needs to be made great again even includes health. And get this, they appointed the former princeling of the losing party to make America healthy again. Yes, President-elect Donald Trump has appointed Robert Kennedy Jr. to be his Secretary of Health and Human Services. Kennedy's Make America Healthy Again agenda is said to focus on combating chronic diseases, reducing corporate influence on health policy, and overhauling healthcare systems. Wow. His initiative even includes reforming the nation's food chain. And that leads us to ask, how will Robert Kennedy Jr. and his MAHA movement reform how we eat? Well, who better to ask than my good friend and fellow revolutionary, David Bloom, farmer at Whiskey Hill Farm in Freedom, California, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, proprietor of Bloom Distillation, and now candidate to be Robert Kennedy Jr.'s what?
Food and Energy Coordinator.
Food and Energy Coordinator. Wow. That's a pretty big deal.
Well, yes, it is, because what we're really talking about doing is taking the revolution into Washington, D.C., and actually making changes in policies that we've needed to do for 60 years.
And why did Robert Kennedy Jr. call David Bloom up and say, hey, you're a candidate?
Well, a lot of people called him and put my name in the hat. Mm-hmm. And the reason has to do with Robert Kennedy taking some really, really, we think, common sense positions other people say are radical. And he just, you know, decided that maybe people being poisoned by eating their food was not good for the health of the country. I mean, I know that's such a radical thought, but oh my gosh, is he getting attacked for his proposals? I mean, just blizzards of scathing criticism of him from the established agricultural community.
Well, one would expect that would happen anytime you try to change something that's been so thoroughly ingrained in our way of doing things, you're going to catch some flack. And I'm happy that your name is on the table, because you're a very good revolutionary and you think like a very good revolutionary. So we're bound to come up with some interesting things, and they're bound to take some flack, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a good flack jacket. I've been putting up with that most of my life, being a little ahead of the traditional thinking and always coming up with new solutions that are elegant, ecological, and make sense, and are profitable on top of it.
On top of it. Amen. New way of thinking for America's agriculture. Well, a quick thumbnail, David Bloom, Whiskey Hill Farm.
Well, Whiskey Hill Farms is right here in Watsonville, California, which is the salad bowl of the United States. Mm-hmm. We grow most of the...
Isn't it in Freedom?
Well, technically, we are in Freedom. That's correct. And I like to say I live in Freedom every day, you know? So it goes with my radical point of view about agriculture, which is, you know, food ought to be healthy and we ought to grow it in the way it would work in nature in a really good environment. And teaching farmers how to do the things I do, even on grants from the USDA, which in the past would have never been the case. But there is some light, you know, finding its way into that dark, smoky room of chemical agriculture.
Yeah, well, I like to think of it as industrialized agriculture, where you take people out of it and put machines and chemicals in it, and take the biology out of the soil and replace it with inert substances.
I wish they were inert, but they're usually not. Extremely poisonous. But I'm really a fan of digital agriculture. I'm holding up my 10 digits in front of you,
Michael. There you go.
Because, you know, small farming is actually the rule rather than the exception around the world. I'll give you the numbers. 525,000 farms around the world. 500,000 of them are under 2 acres.
Amen. Farmers of 40 centuries, as F.H. King put it many years ago. How do you farm one place for 40 centuries and still be able to take out of the soil by putting things back in the soil, right?
You're absolutely right, Michael. And, you know, some time ago, I was out there at Rodale in the eastern part of the United States, and somebody was talking about this new word, sustainable agriculture. And we were sitting around the table drinking, well, maybe it was called sustainable beer, I can't remember. But at any rate, we were talking about this stupid word. And
sustainable?
Yes, sustainable. So I recently, relatively recently, taught a permaculture course on the Blackfoot Indian Nation, well, I guess you call them reservations.
Ooh, about whitefish country?
Browning.
Browning, okay, yeah. On the other side of the hill.
That's right. And so, the medicine elder who invited me to teach there, he was introducing himself to the class, and he said, this sustainable ag thing I've been hearing about, I don't quite understand it. Can someone tell me what that means? And this one perky co-ed stands up and says, well, Mr. Fish, this is about making sure that people in 7 generations have the same level of resources we have today. Wilbert, he scratches his chin and he says, well, I think that's a really great idea, but when are you white people going to fix all the stuff you screwed up? And his point was that sustainable agriculture means don't let things get any worse than they are today. Yeah. That's the really, now, regenerative agriculture.
It's building it back.
That's right. With every crop, with every act, we heal and rebuild and amplify, make more productive the food production that we're doing.
So we are talking revolution here when it gets right down to it. And speaking of revolution, let's go back to this crazy election that we just had. Mm-hmm. And now we have Donald J. Trump and Robert Kennedy Jr. working together to make America great and healthy again. Wow. Isn't that amazing?
Well, you know, the longer I live, I am less surprised all the time. There are so many paradoxes that came up, and sometimes they work out for the best.
Yes. Well, looking around the world right now, you know, I see what happened in Syria just a few days ago. Boom. A 50-year dynasty or something like that, a long-term dynasty there, wiped out in a few days, nothing left of it. I look to Russia and I look to China and I see embedded dictators running the show, and the show is falling apart. And I think we should be very grateful that we have a revolution every 2 and then 4 years. Every mm-hmm. We throw them out. Or keep them if they're good.
Yeah.
So we should be very grateful that we had a revolution that somehow brought together Donald Trump and Robert Kennedy Jr. Tell us about Robert Kennedy Jr.
Well,
we all know about Trump, but tell us about Robert Kennedy Jr. Yeah. I called him a princeling of the Democrat Party?
Well, sure. I mean, his family has been involved in politics for decades and decades. So, you know, and he's a bit of a black sheep in his own family. But I got to say, his approach to agriculture right now is shockingly sensible. What he's saying is a lot of the chronic disease we have is due to the way we have been farming and the way we make food. So if you look back in agricultural chemical history, prior to World War II, there wasn't much chemicals used in agriculture, very few. But World War II happened, and things were quite different. We had, well, we had a war. And we, as Americans, wanted to kill the Germans, and they wanted to kill us. And so the Germans were first. They went ahead and made organophosphate war gases, you know, to spray on our troops and kill them in nervous system breakdown, horrible chemicals. Well, we came in with our own version, the chlorinated hydrocarbons, and we sprayed that on the Germans, and it killed their troops. Now, no one really wants to use the terms that are true, which is chemical warfare, is what both sides were using. So here we are using two chemicals meant to kill people. And now, at the end of World War II, the companies that were making a fortune making these chemicals, IG Farben and in Germany and Dow and all the big DuPont and all the guys here, they all said, hey, can we keep making this stuff? It kills bugs really well. So, you know, it does kill bugs, but do you want to spray on your food stuff meant to kill people and tell us that it's safe? And Robert Kennedy is saying that kind of thinking has got to end.
Wow. That's a revolutionary thought, because you're going up against very big money. Not only that, but you're going up against an agriculture that has become accustomed to not using their 10 digits.
That's correct.
To grow food, but instead using their equipment and their chemicals. And makes it pretty easy for them. When it gets right down to it, one farmer can now grow 10,000 acres of corn with no weeds, no bugs. All you have to do is use chemical warfare, right?
Yes, and nature keeps fighting back and winning, so you have to use more and more chemicals.
Because you keep more and more. So there's the cycle that we are in, and it's a cycle that Robert Kennedy Jr. says is making us sick. And making us sick in a very long-term way.
Short-term, long-term, every which way. And even changing things about our society. You know, some of those trends we can talk about in more detail.
And we will right after this break that we're coming up against. But we are talking revolution.
Yes,
with
a necessary one.
With David Bloom, who is a candidate for Robert Kennedy Jr.'s new effort to make America healthy again by changing the way we grow our food and process our food and eat our food. Major deal. That is making America healthy again. This is The Food Chain. We will be right back after this brief time out. So do not go away. It's going to get really interesting.
now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program and Podcast. I am Michael Olson, and I am with David Bloom, my longtime friend. Boy, we've been talking on the radio a long time when it gets right down to it.
Might be 20 years by now, Michael.
There we are. And so we're both revolutionary thinkers about agriculture. Both of us kind of focusing on a different way of growing our food. And it's a way that is not new. It's the way we've always done it.
And the consequences of the way we've been doing it the last 60 years, are coming to haunt us at this point. You know, you and I were just talking about pesticides, for instance, and how they were used as war gases.
Chemical warfare, yes.
Yeah, so we still are committing chemical warfare against the bugs, right? So we use 1 billion pounds of pesticides a year in the United States. That's 3 pounds for every American. That's a lot of poison, okay? So it ends up in our water, it ends up in our food, and, you know, there's two ways that pesticides affect human beings and also other animals. One is they're directly poisonous, you know, like it was in World War II. So
kill people, kill bugs.
Exactly. So the amount of chemicals it takes to kill you is, you know, vanishingly small. It's in 0.5 milligram per kilogram. Well, that's, you know, a scientific term, of course. But what that equals is a vanishingly small amount of these chemicals. If you ingest it, it's in your body. It's reacting with all your body systems, and you can be killed within hours. From a dose of slightly more pesticide than anyone intended. But pesticides don't stay where you put them. You know, no one sits there and paints a plant with liquid pesticides. They spray it, you know, from tractors, and, you know, wind happens, you know, and it can be miles of drifting. And then you breathe some in, and all of a sudden, you could have a lot of problems, like with breathing and your heart stopping and all that good stuff. But poisons like this are more insidious. I remember giving a lecture and talking about the effect of pesticides on the nervous system. And one of the things it does is it mimics multiple sclerosis. So if you have a nerve going through your body, it's carrying electricity. But just like any wire, there's insulation around that wire so that the electricity doesn't go wild any which direction. What pesticides do is they peel back that insulation. And so now there can be sparking between nerves. And all of a sudden that ends up being convulsions and you die. And during this lecture, here was the thing. One person stood up and said, "I got to tell you, I'm at the bottom of a valley with agriculture on both sides, and 8 people in the 2-mile stretch of my road have multiple sclerosis, they say."
There you are.
And of course it wasn't. It was pesticide poisoning.
Mm-hmm. And you see it in the animal populations, wild animals. Is it safe to say that with 1 billion pounds of pesticides applied to our country every year, that we are simply infused with chemicals that can kill us?
Well, they do.
They do kill us.
Now, the other way that they kill people is all in the numbers. In other words, before World War II, the number of people who would get, for instance, breast cancer, very small number. But since World War II, that has skyrocketed to become an enormously common malady that people suffer. And that has to do with the fact that most of these pesticides are what we call estrogenic compounds. They act like estrogen. So in the case of breast cancer, if you get too much estrogen, it causes breast tissue to become cancerous. It mutates the cells because we're not supposed to have that much estrogen in our system. There was something that happened at the start of the...
I think glyphosate is a great example of that as well.
Oh, my gosh. Glyphosate meaning Roundup, you know. Right. I'll get back to that in just a second, Michael.
Sure. Because
I have a special place in my heart for attacking glyphosate. But we might remember that right at the start of the wave of changing abortion rights, and there was a girl in Illinois who had been raped by her father and was pregnant, and she couldn't get an abortion in the city that she was in. She had to go across state lines to get that, and that's what the story was about. But the story should have been about the fact that she was only 10 years old and she was pregnant. And no one picked up on that. And so think about
this. Precocious.
Well,
puberty.
Yes. And most of us would say, oh, no, girls don't start becoming fertile until they're 12 or 13. That's been the conventional wisdom ever since I've been a kid. Here's a girl who's 10 years old and she was pregnant. That should have been the story. Not that about abortion or non-abortion. It was about the fact that the food she was eating caused her, because so much estrogen was entering her bloodstream, that she became fertile years earlier than she should have. So that is the start of what estrogenic chemicals mean. Now, if you're talking about males, you know, and a lot of us have issues with this around the world, in Norway, they have a real health system, you know, national mm-hmm. health system. They keep really good statistics. So they're noticing that the need to go to fertility clinics.
Sperm counts. Yeah.
Oh. You got it, Michael. So they noticed that all these men were having problem with their sperm not really doing the job. And the women were okay, but the men were losing fertility and getting down more and more, where 50% of their sperm was not swimming, okay? Yep. So the deal with that is that is an effect of estrogenic chemicals, because you're getting female hormone damaging the testes in men. So these subtle things are not so subtle when you start looking at the numbers. Now, people said, the oil company said, oh, no, it's got to be something else. Maybe they smoke cigarettes or maybe they drink too much. That must be what's killing their sperm. So the Norwegians thought about that for a second, because what the oil companies were saying, you don't have a control group of people who don't have pesticides and show that their sperm is good. Well, the Norwegians thought about that for a minute and they said, oh, we do have a control group. They had 24 organic farmers in Norway, and they tested those guys' sperm 100%. So we did have a control group.
Wow. And there we are. Well, I think it's evident to everybody, even those who sell the pesticides, that it's tough on life to inculcate these poisons into our bodies, into our environment. Okay, that's a lot of money.
Oh, billions.
Robert
billions billions.
Kennedy Jr. and his team, which might be you, David Bloom.
I'd like to be there doing it.
Now, you're going to go up against an entrenched industry, and both in the chemicals, but also in agriculture. So how do we do this?
Well, I'm no stranger to going up against the big guys. My book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, put oil companies directly in the gun sights for polluting our environment with that toxic waste called gasoline. So
when we could be using alcohol
made by farmers, you know, to run our cars totally cleanly.
Which we did at one time.
That's right. The first cars didn't run on gasoline. There wasn't any. They ran on alcohol until... a fellow named Rockefeller, he had this product he came out with called heating oil, kerosene, right? But that was the heavy part of the oil, which you could burn and keep your house warm. But the other stuff, all the benzenes and toluenes and xylenes, all the volatile, horrible stuff, he had to get rid of. There was no use for it before cars came around. So he flushed it into rivers at night, figuring nobody would notice. But of course, oil
the rivers
caught water.
Fire. Yeah, there
exactly,
you go.
Michael. Yeah. So, so this is I've been going up against that industry for a long time with various levels of success. And my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, is now on every energy minister's bookshelf in the world.
Yeah.
And in most colleges.
That's where it should be there, by golly.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a major revolution in our food chain so that we can be healthy again. We can't be healthy again until we stop eating unhealthy things.
Poison. Yeah. So Robert Kennedy has dared to say in public that pesticides, as we've been talking about, have to be eliminated from our food, and they're causing health problems. Well, the oil company, and not the oil companies, they're involved too, but the agricultural interests are saying, oh, that's a crazy idea. And they say other things that he comes up with are crazy ideas, like, well, this whole thing about sexual dysphoria, in other words, young people not sure just what gender they are. Well, it's really interesting because, you know, hormones, remember, estrogenic hormones, aren't toxins, so to speak, but they're signaling systems in our body. So on the 17th day of gestation, if you get a few quadrillionths of a gram, that's a very small number, of estrogen at a key moment, you'll have a change in the sex of the fetus. So most people don't know that all fetuses start off as female. And at the right moment, a bit of testosterone switches the fetus to develop as a male. But if instead they get a dose of estrogen from eating a tuna, which is concentrated that stuff from the environment, all of a sudden the body is confused and goes back part of the way, all the way back to being female. And so there's a struggle in the development of that fetus over the next 9 months to deal with the effects of hormones that the body wasn't making. And
from our food and maybe our environment as well.
Absolutely. So if there's one place that these pesticides shouldn't be used, it's on our food. Now, you want to kill mosquitoes where there's malaria? You know, there's other ways to do that, but, you know, you could kind of make a case for that in some places, but not on our food. And that's got to stop. And guess what? We know how to do it. We don't need to do it.
We may know how to do it, but there yes, are Michael. Others that don't know how to do it. Will have to be induced somehow into doing it. And I think the problem will be money and overcoming the moneyed interests that control things.
That's part of it. But the other part is there's been such a preaching of the chemical way of doing agriculture is the modern, efficient way that around the world people are been propagandized into thinking that might be true. But it's not impossible to change because, as you know, Michael, there is 525,000 farms in the world. That's a lot of farms.
That's a lot of farms.
But 500,000 of those farms are only 2 acres or less.
And they feed people who are relatively close to them, so they don't have to travel great distances to get their food from 2 acres, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so they have to be close.
So who are these other 25,000 big farms? Well, what are they growing? Well, in America, they grow corn and they grow soybeans. And when was the last time you ate corn? Well, you know,
when I had that steak.
Well, yes, because the corn feeding the cow is really what's going on. But remember, we feed the cow 10 pounds of corn, it poops out 9 pounds, and 1 pound becomes meat. But the thing is, what do we actually use corn for? Well, we use it for breakfast cereal. That's like a fraction of 1% of the corn grown. And then the other thing we use it for is making whiskey, and I do argue that that is food, but the other uses of corn are industrial, modified food starch and all kinds of other industrial chemicals.
Cooking oil.
That's right, corn oil, for instance. Corn oil, but fully hydrogenated, meaning you can't digest it, you know, because that's the only way you can sell it, you know, and keep it fresh. So it's a damaged food, you know, being it's not even a food, it's a damaged industrial chemical masquerading as food.
Yeah. And a lot of people making a lot of money on it. And the government subsidizes its production, which gets us right back to the government and what we can do. One of the things that Robert Kennedy Jr. is talking about doing is redirecting subsidies from those producers, those farmers of commodity products like corn and soy and whatnot, to local agriculture. Where is he going to redirect the money?
Well, this is what's being determined now, and that's why I want to be part of that process, because I think I know better than a lot of other people how to do this.
Amen. I think you do too, as evidenced by your Whiskey Hill Farm in Freedom, California. Wow. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about revolution here. We just had an election, and that's exactly what a revolution is an election of sorts. And we had one. We bringing in the new people who are going to make America healthy again. We have one who's signing up for that crusade, and he is David Bloom with us today. And when we come back from this break, I'd like to dig into how we face up to change something that is so ingrained and so embedded in our way of life.
And ingrained, that's a good one.
It's a good one. And we're talking about industrial agriculture and you. So do stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We are talking revolution in the United States of America. We just had an election, and we're in the process of throwing out the old regime and bringing in a new one. Part of the new one is none other than Robert Kennedy Jr., who Donald J. Trump is bringing in to make America healthy again. And to do that, we're going to have a revolution in our food chain. And in essence, David Bloom suggests that the first thing we need to do is get rid of the chemicals, right? The bad chemicals that for decades have been used to kill people, and we're using them to grow food.
Well, there's no controversy about that, except in the mind of agribusiness. There are thousands of studies literally showing the negative effects of these chemicals. And you know, Jeffrey Smith, actually one of my permaculture students from the past, is a crusader against Roundup, otherwise known as glyphosate. And Roundup, think about how that was developed. They genetically modified corn so that it could tolerate this weed killer called Roundup. So in other words, the weeds that were not genetically modified, well, they died when they got hit with the herbicide, but the corn that's been genetically modified doesn't die. But it absorbs all these chemicals, and the way glyphosate works is it soaks into the plant, and then it goes down into the roots and kills the roots of the plant, and then the roots full of that chemical decompose under the soil, and they're there poisoning the soil micro-life. Now that's where fertility really comes from. So I'm going to do an early plug for my candidacy for this food and agriculture.
Wait a minute. Let's tell people, by golly, David Bloom is running for office here,
yes,
right there on the Food Chain radio program. And the office he is running for is to participate in the campaign of Robert Kennedy Jr. to make our food and ourselves healthy again.
So the way you can vote for me, and I'll also say this at the end of the show, you can go to my website, which is very fascinating with lots of clips to look at. Alcohol can be a gas, for one. That's my book on energy and agriculture, which is what I'm running for. And the other one is Whiskey Hill Farms. Now, if you go to Alcohol Can Be a Gas, there'll be a place there that you can go ahead and vote for me, sending a note to Washington that this guy, me, should be part of the policy. The other thing that you can find out there is my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, which has been an Amazon bestseller and sold tens of thousands of copies. So that's usually a good endorsement for something that works.
Best there is.
Yeah. I am now giving that book away free online in a Kindle format. Now, forever, I've been selling it as a hardcover, you know, $60 mm-hmm. book, but... You know, it's time for the revolution, so I want as many people as possible to have access to what we have, and it is a great book. So, Alcohol Can Be a Gas on our website. There's a place you can click a button, and you can get your own free copy from Kindle on your lucky day, December 13th, Friday the 13th. And there are other days coming up after that. You get 5 free days a year from Kindle to give away books. So you can have one of mine.
Wow, there you go. Now, some time ago, I had the opportunity to speak at the International Biotech Convention in Chicago, McCormick Place. On the panel with me were like the presidents of the commodity groups, president of the Corn Growers Association, hog and soy and all of them. And somehow me, which was, I don't know how that happened, David, but there I was. And so in our concluding remarks, I said, we're here speaking to the audience, which consisted of people who genetically modified foods, organisms. I said, you folks have created a miracle for these people on the panel with me. You've made it possible for one person to grow 10,000 acres of crops with no weeds or no bugs. And they're very happy. You're very happy. You're making tons of money. They are too. Everybody's happy here. But one day, people who eat your food are going to wonder, hey, what's in this stuff for us other than food that has been infused with herbicide and sprayed with pesticide? Is that what you're feeding us? And I said, you're going to have to find an answer. What are you going to tell them?
Well, one of the ways to tell them is you sue them into the ground. And right now, the makers of, which is no longer Monsanto, it's now Bayer, they're losing billions of dollars in lawsuits due to glyphosate, and that's kept very quiet.
And they're still making glyphosate and still selling it.
That's right. But let's talk about the positive side of this, because how do you deal with bugs? Well, on 10,000 acres of corn, you could even there do something about it. But on my farm, what do I do? Because I use no poisons, even so-called organic pesticides that are considered safe for humans. So what I do is I look at bugs as a surplus. If I have too many bugs, I have a surplus of bugs. And as an ecologist, I always work with surpluses and shortages to figure out how to balance an ecological system. So when I first moved into my farm, it had been, abused terribly by chemical farmers for a whole generation before I got in, and the place was loaded with bugs. Now, typically, 20 tons of bugs move through every acre every year. That's the weight of 20 automobiles of meat, right? So that's an interesting surplus. So what I did is I hung a light up in my in the rafters of my greenhouse, and it shined out the door, and bugs could see it for a mile away, and they came to the light. So I was making a bigger surplus of bugs. Now, when they got there, there was someone else following that light to my farm, and that were the frogs. So, because frogs know that bugs go to light. So they get to where the light is, and under the light is a pile of rocks, and a little pond, a little 10-foot long, 1-foot wide pond. And when the frogs get there, they look at those two things and they go, oh, jacuzzi, condominium, I'm moving in. So each female frog can lay up to 700 eggs. And so suddenly these ponds are like thick with frog eggs. And then there's little frog tadpoles. And then there's little frogs with baby little feet. And then at one point they all jump out of the pond at the same time out of instinct, because the idea is if we all jump at once, the predators can't get all of us, you know. So those frogs go out of my greenhouse and they work at night, night shift, and each one of them eats 167 bugs a night. And these frogs are only a little bigger than my thumb. They're not giant bullfrogs.
Yeah. Well, David, these techniques have been practiced for millenniums, as evidenced by F.H. King's Farmer of 40 Centuries. Mm-hmm. Look what these people are doing. It's amazing. It's what you're doing that is amazing. But you have to come to grips with dealing with an industrialized system that is set up contrary to sustainability.
You mean regeneration?
Regeneration. Well, sustainability and regeneration. And interestingly enough, as a quick sidebar, California is trying to come to grips with sustainable agriculture. They have a committee, and they're going to develop an official designation for what sustainable is. Couldn't come up with a word. Couldn't come up with a definition.
Because it doesn't make sense as defined.
Yeah.
So my concept for this is something I've going to be posing with the USDA is something called a food hub. Because as we talked at the start of the program, most farmers are small. So they can't go out and build fermenters for soil bacteria to enrich their soil with that bacteria that replaces the need for for fertilizers. They can't use vibrating plows to loosen the soil down to 3 feet so air can get down there and life can get down there making food for the plants. But those can be done on a regional basis. And so my concept for a food hub has multiple services that either can be purchased inexpensively, you know, as a nonprofit kind of thing, or can help farmers be able to create new things. For instance, a basalt foundry, which is a basalt of volcanic rock, the most common one. It's if mild steel is about a hardness of 4 and stainless steel is 5.5, the hardness is steel going to 10, which is diamond, basalt 8.8. So what if I give a farmer a block of wax and I say, carve the tool that you imagine, and they carve it the way they think it'll work in their field, and I put it in sand and I pour this molten lava into that wax, which runs away, and now I've got a cheap, you know, $5 cost to make this prototype tool for the farmer to use, and then come back and say, now I know how I want to modify it. Here's another block of wax. To have the foundry, a farmer can't have that, but to have that regionally, it taps the creativity of every farmer who's always thinking about, how can I do that a little faster? How can I do that with no damage to my soil? How can I aerate my soil better so all the micro life does all the work for me, dissolving rocks and grit into fertilizer? And so providing those 500,000 small farmers with food hubs that help them do even more than they do now to make their land regenerative.
There it is. You have to figure out how to make it regenerative, sustainable, organic, but it also has to be profitable. Otherwise, they go away like your frogs.
Yep.
They crawl away at night. So how do we pull this off?
And I'll tell you, even I, you know, who's really sharp at all this stuff, none of us farmers are more than maybe one crop failure away from losing our land, because it costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I had we had these horrible storms here in California in the winter of 22, 23, where we had like a 500-year rain event. Oh, but there's no global warming or climate change, but we'll put that aside. Anyway, I lost my turmeric crop that was worth $1.7 million because of the cold and the rain. And I have been having a hard time 2 years later
coming
rising out of it, and I might not be able to, you know. And so people are stepping up to try to help us weather the bankruptcy and foreclosure that were looming in front of us.
I'd like to jump in and say perhaps that's something that Robert Kennedy Jr. could do, is by redirecting the crop insurance program to better suit small farmers in situations like you had, where you have a big crop. Yeah, you had a big crop and a small parcel of land, and there was a hurricane, and so we do indemnify commodity crop farmers.
That's right.
For things like that. And if Robert Kennedy Jr. can come to grips with figuring out how, you know, what we do for great big farmers that have commodity crops that we don't really eat anyway, that we use to eat from the derivatives of those crops, if he can find some way of helping small farms, both in land tenure, which is, I mean, the land around here in California is unbelievably expensive.
That's right. And yet, farm trusts exist, and that's our strategy for passing through our crisis, is pulling together a consortium of interests that will help us relieve us of the mortgages and then put the land permanently into a land trust where no one can speculate on it. I couldn't sell it. No one else could sell it. And it would be there for regenerative agriculture forever.
And we're doing a lot of land trusts now. So perhaps that's something that Robert Kennedy Jr. could look at. Also, I think of concern to me is how distribution has been altered by the failure to enforce the Robinson-Patman Act.
Yes.
Of 1936. We had no food deserts until 1980, when they stopped enforcing that one act. But there's so much that can be done.
Well, you should explain to people briefly what
that
act is. I
only have 1 minute left.
Oh, okay. I'll save that for another show.
It's another show, and it's an incredible story. The story of how we manufactured food deserts here in the United States, everywhere. But anyway, we have David Bloom with us here today, and you can vote for him by going to Alcohol Can Be a Gas or Whiskey Hill Farm. Vote for him to serve with Robert Kennedy Jr. on making America healthy again, right?
And to reach me, you can get me toll-free at 888-737-6228 to discuss any of this.
Okay, this is David Bloom, Whiskey Hill Farms. Just Google Whiskey Hill Farms or Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Thank you all for tuning in, and I'll see you more next week for more What's Eating What Radio on The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.